started. I had realized that some of you, I've been introducing myself. I'm Merritt Trostes from Pacific Lutheran University, where I teach theology and constructive theology and Lutheran theology and some courses in women's studies. But I thought, there's a number of you who I've seen your faces all week, and I don't know your names. And so I thought, I'm going to ask them if we could just go around and have you offer your name and where you're from. That would be great, so that I have at least the sound of your voice, for those of you who have not offered comments, and your name to connect to here. If we could just start up here and we'll go across.
I'm Corrine from Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Ken, I belong to her.
Anna Stevenson from Madison.
Catherine from Chicago.
Jenny from
Shelton.
All right. Carl Johnson from Union near Shelton, near Lakeview.
And I'm Sue Johnson. And we go to the same church in Shelton and live in Union.
All right. I'm Brian Kingsrider from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Elaine Allen from St. Paul, in Union.
I'm Barbie Pease from Madison, Wisconsin.
Peter from Bellingham, and I help pay your salary.
All right. Hopefully you'll like the class.
I'm Rebecca from St. Paul.
Alden. Rebecca's husband.
Hi, I'm Rebecca from Vancouver, BC.
I'm Karen from Minneapolis.
I'm Andy from St. Paul. Dennis from Minneapolis.
Danette from Storm Lake, Iowa.
Park from Tacoma.
Yeah. I'm Carl from Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Clara from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Ron from Seattle.
Daniel from Shelton, Washington.
John from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Susan from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Peter Carlson from Seattle.
Oh, I'm Dar from Austin, Texas.
Wes Howell from Bellevue, Washington.
Steve Yano from Edmonds, Washington.
J.R. from Sikkim, Texas.
And up in the balcony.
Yeah. Hi.
Minnesota.
Yep.
Oh, this is good. Good weather for us here. I have put on the wall, over the course of the week, we've been looking at different perspectives on the cross. We started off with 2 days where we looked at the main questions around the cross. And I didn't post our work back up today, but we looked at questions as to why did Jesus die and the variety of responses. The massive variety of responses that we actually had for that. We kept filling that sheet of paper and adding more and more comments in. Even who killed him, from God, Jesus, the devil, we did, I did, the Romans, on and on. Was it necessary? Was it planned from the beginning of time? These kinds of questions. For whom? Who needed it? We asked a number of questions and found, actually, before we delved into all of these theologians, I wanted us to be able to see that we are as bright as they are in the sense that we ourselves can come up with all these different interpretations of the cross before we even get into them. But it gives us an idea of the vast variety in our own tradition. We also looked at traditional interpretations of the cross, of atonement, the next day, and looked at Origen, Abelard, Anselm, and some of the reformers, Christus Victor kind of models. We looked at different dominant themes and dominant models, and then we dove into the contemporary discussions of the cross. And we had our first day back on this wall in this corner. You have, on Wednesday, we talked about womanist, black women, Christian women's interpretations of the cross. We had Kelly Brown Douglas, we talked about Dolores Williams talking critique of the cross as a central symbol. and Joanne Marie Terrell and her appreciation of the cross and the power in the blood of Jesus' death. We moved on yesterday and talked about, back here we have some white feminist theologians, Carter Hayward, Joanne Carlson Brown, Carol Bone, Rebecca Parker, and an Asian feminist theologian, Rita Nakashima Brock, looking at women's experience of abuse and of suffering and the acculturation of women to sacrifice themselves, and especially in situations of domestic violence, how the cross can be particularly odious. At least two of our articles and two of our people had said, suffering is never redemptive. It's not salvific. Salvation is not camped in murder. And if we say that it is, we glorify something that is just truly horrible. But life and protection of life and relationship and restoration of life is what we need to throw our weight into as what is truly salvific, what is saving for humanity. So they proposed that kind of critique and offered in the bottom of Rita Bronca and Rebecca Parker's there, love, courage, relationship, presence with a capital P. They talk about truth and life, that these are redemptive. And later in their book, Saving Paradise, which was in the bookstore, they talk about this image of paradise and how early Christians hung their hat. Their claim is early Christians hung their hat on this hope of paradise and the demand of life and baptismal imagery and things like this instead of crosses as their central symbol. And it will be interesting to hear, this book just came out last month, and so it will be great to hear the conversations develop. I'm sure there'll be and even before I came down here, Cynthia Molavita and I were talking about, you know, there'll be lots of conversations over whether that's historically accurate or not, you know, and there's scholarship on that and kind of that review of that. I'm sure we'll have a lot of discussion around that. And then that question also of, you know, how much do we need it to be, true to be provocative, to simply raise another idea. That might sound a little bit strange, but in some ways it's like, can it just be a provocative what if, you know, that we live with, what if this is the interpretation? So we've had many interpretations of the cross. Back in this corner, we have what I promised last time, and if you can't see it, I'll try to read them out loud too, was some Lutheran women, feminist and Mujerista theologians looking at Luther's theology of the cross. And Alicia Vargas, we talked about, she appropriates that term, theology of the cross, from Luther, and she holds that in light of a liberation theology, a Latin liberation theology perspective, and talks about for Latina women in the United States, the image of Jesus on the cross is helpful because it is that idea of solidarity with oppression, that Jesus shares the slaps, and therefore I know I can survive to the next day. I'm not alone in this suffering, in this oppression, but I can get through it because Jesus is alongside of me. And promises a release, ultimately promises a release from the captivity. Mary Solberg in the corner, she teaches at Gustavus Adolphus, and Alicia Vargas is at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. Mary Solberg teaches at Gustavus Adolphus College, and she does an earlier and fantastic book looking very thoroughly at Luther's theology of the cross. And she says that she would prefer it to be called an epistemology of the cross. And I could probably say off the bat, really, when people talk about, I've worked with this concept for a very long time, Luther's theology of the cross, but when most people come up and they say, well, I really love Luther's theology of the cross, I have to say, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by Luther's theology of the cross? Because people mean many, 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 many things. they use that term in lots of ways, not necessarily how Luther used it. That doesn't mean that they can't use it. They should use it. It doesn't have to be how Luther used it, but it is helpful for our conversations to know what we're talking about, like whether we're talking, agreeing, like I like it too. We might be talking about two very different things, I don't know. Mary Silver goes back and says, what Luther is talking about with an epistemology of the cross is that it is how we see or know God. That we see God through the cross, through the trouble and the pain in the world. And it encourages us, first off, she says as an ethicist, seeing the pain of the world honestly helps us to acknowledge it, see it, and then act on it. But we oftentimes don't want to see the pain of the world in the first place. And to think that, and she recounts her own experience of first going to El Salvador and being confronted with this image of kind of what her government was doing in El Salvador and denying it and saying, this just seems very skewed and wrong. And she said, and I've been in other situations where I've been kind of confronted with an ugly truth that I don't want to look at. And so that idea of going through denial and then actually being able to say, okay, I'm willing to see this and I'm willing to accept that it might be the case and or that it is the case. And now, once we're conscious of suffering, she says, and oppression, we are ethically obliged and motivated to change our lives and work for justice. So she talks about, but she does say, along with some others, that Luther, the theology of the cross, even this term, within the last 150 years has been used more and more and more and more and more and more and more. We are, I think, actually developing a whole tradition of theologies of the cross in the Lutheran tradition within the last 150 years, far more than was ever the case before that. So that term has become used a lot more. And Mary Solberg talks about that as a way of knowing, not the central thing. She says justification by faith was what Luther centered his theology around. But how do we know God? How do we come to know God? And she talks about this way of seeing through the pain of the world and seeing God's presence, seeing God there. Other Lutheran feminists with similar appreciation for aspects, and I'll say aspects, not all, of Luther's theology of the cross, would be Deanna Thompson, I put it up there, and Cynthia Moldavida, and maybe you've been to some of her classes too. I know on Monday she might have had a class where she talked about, Catherine and I had talked about that afterwards, that we had all this cross discussion that day. And Cynthia has done fantastic work, too, of applying a theology of the cross in ecological situations. Deanna Thompson, she wrote a book where she's trying to bridge the gap between feminist theology's critiques of the cross in the last 20 years and Lutheran appreciation of the cross, and of trying to kind of bridge this, and it's even called Crossing the Divide, Bridging the Divide, her book. She is at McAllister College in St. Paul.
Hamlin,
I'm sorry, that's right. Deanna writes that the Lutheran theology of the cross keeps us honest and realistic about the pain and trouble of the world. Somewhat like Mary Solberg, the cross disrupts our beautiful theologies, which have served to oppress and suppress women. She offers that the crucified woman image is something that we can reclaim in the sense that it's the location. She talks about it could be a location that God is understood to be today. If we imagine the crucified woman on the cross, she says it challenges the maleness of God and some of the sexist structures and systems. That the cross is a mirror in the sense that Jesus takes our place, justifies and frees us, and so that we no longer have to valorize sacrifice. And that the cross reveals a God who befriends humanity, laying down his life, a friend, acting freely, giving his life for friends. So she picks those themes up. But I think It has been a great and interesting and developing conversation, because there has been, and within the last years, several feminist Lutheran theologians have been trying to address some of the critiques of other feminist theologians, and it's been necessary, because for a little while there, we were all still talking about these theologies of the cross without having enough work done on how will we reinterpret this in light of these very profound critiques that have come out. Those are some options. Any thoughts or responses in kind of hearing this variety so far before we move on to the cross and imperialism? Yeah.
I'm wondering, in the Lutheran seminaries, is this whole banquet laid out before aspiring clergy people? I'm wondering, what do pastors in the pulpits, what's their theology, or what are they coming with to congregations?
Oh, that's a good question. It really depends on your class, your professor, and where you go to seminary. So I don't think I could ever answer that question. But you don't have to delve too far, I don't think, into the theological world today to hear the controversy around the cross. It's not, I think I had mentioned on the first day, it's not like this is a little side conversation that's going on that a few people are paying attention to. I think it is a hot and bothersome topic. And people are engaged. They want to talk about it a lot. And I've been very surprised. We had, in picking up these authors, even at the American Academy of Religion, I had mentioned we had just this, you know, panel, supposedly small panel of authors, you know, presenting these different perspectives. They were very passionate, and the place was packed, and people were very passionate in response, shaking their heads, and no, 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 you know, and so the meaning of the cross, I think we are struggling with what, how to interpret all of this in light of all the suffering.
There was one pastor who left either yesterday or Wednesday, mm-hmm. who was talking about this class and how wonderful it was to expose these things that she didn't get in seminary. I believe she went to Luther Seminary, mm-hmm. and asked her when she was there, and she said 98 through 2002, which really surprised me, because she said they wouldn't touch it. Mm-hmm. It was established, this is it, we're not going to mess with this stuff. And I was surprised that she said now they're doing it, but as recently as 2002, they weren't. I don't know if that covers everything, but that surprised me.
Do you have any statistics on the percentage of people who wear crosses as symbols?
Oh, gosh, no. No, it's a great question, or why they wear crosses.
That was good. If anybody asked them why.
Yeah, we did a little, the first day we did talk about there's both the theology and the interpretations of the cross that we've been dealing with primarily this week. And then there's actually the symbol of the cross itself and the myriad of things. And we added also, we made a list of all the different things it could mean, from burning crosses and racism to wooden crosses where we pin our pieces of paper during Lent and burn them into roses, or, you know, there's just a bazillion ways the cross is used. And so, no, I have no idea about that. And rap stars, we talked about all the different pop manifestations of what the cross is and what does it mean even there. But it's a great, one of the authors in the book, she said, I might not like the symbol of the cross that much. This is Susan Nelson, she said, but it's not going away. And so she said, so I may as well, I'm going to come up with some interpretation of it, because it's not going anywhere. Now others would say, well, it shouldn't go anywhere. I mean, I think a vast majority would say it shouldn't go anywhere.
I just did a little scanning last night through the synoptics to find out Jesus, mm-hmm. when they have him commenting on the cross, mm-hmm. 90% of it deals with pure discipleship, mm-hmm. which isn't what we're talking about at all. Mm-hmm. Well, not directly, mm-hmm. we have been indirectly, mm-hmm. but there's nothing really about atonement, or it's simply discipleship means mm-hmm. that you're going to have to walk down a road that you... Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. the servanthood, and that would be, I mean, at the end of last class or the class before, we were talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and you could go into that kind of the path of Christ, of what it means to walk the way of the cross and the path of Christ and put yourself into, for the sake of the way of Christ, to put yourself in danger.
So the opposite, we were talking about the law yesterday, it actually nudges in the direction of cheap grace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that difficult path. And of course, Bonhoeffer's been raked over the coals. So as Moltmann will talk about him, by a number of these feminist theologians as well, saying kind of a sadomasochistic read of Bonhoeffer and critique. But he's had a profound and important voice. And in seeking, I would say a number of these people, even if they don't like the cross, they will say, suffering can happen on the way to justice. And one has to be courageous about entering into their commitment to life. If that's kind of what they would say. You would be courageous in your commitment to life. It might include death, but it doesn't mean that death is good. They won't say murder's good. That's their phrase on there. When we look at other thoughts or questions on just these, some of these women theologians we've been thinking about for the last couple days. We will, let's talk about some of the perspectives on imperialism, the cross and imperialism, and then open it up to kind of remaining either feelings, questions, concerns about this kind of a conversation. You know, we might think, oh, this is great, it's very freeing. And I would have to say that Brock and Parker, while it's a radical critique, I think it has made space for some people to get back into Christianity. They think, oh, good, I don't have to have that symbol. That symbol means so many horrible things to me, and I cannot be a part of it. There are other avenues in for me in Christianity, whereas other people, it's given a very positive reason, an ethical reason, or walking the way of Christ. Kind of a reason that the cross is important for all these different reasons. So. I think it can expand in a hospitable way theological interpretations within this vast and varied tradition of ours. When we look at today and looking at imperialism and the cross and thinking, I had asked you whether you can think of, and I don't know if you if we can brainstorm on this briefly and just throw out answers of ways that you have you seen the cross or Christian redemptive suffering used in the service of imperialism? Images of that in the last 150 years?
Well, we had the comment made by one of our leaders that we were starting a new crusade. Mm-hmm. Saying the very word crusade, it comes from a cross, and it's carrying the cross. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, whether it was retracted or not later, it was said.
Did you ask about whether it was Constantine painted the Cairo or the cross on the shield? It was the Cairo. And I even wrote it in my introduction and forgot about it. So there's a number of things where you're like, oh, I did know that at one point. Oh, look, I wrote that even. So that answers that question from Monday that you had had. But OK, this idea about, and we are starting a new crusade, meaning?
Well, the whole Islam, Western world struggle that's going on has been painted in terms of a crusade.
Mm-hmm.
We've pulled back and we've been careful, but that was some of the language that was used to start out.
In my studies of American civil religions, there was a lot of rhetoric during World War II where the cross and the flag were held up side by side as the two bulwarks that were going to defeat Nazism and communism. Mm-hmm. But the cross was right there in parallel with the flag.
And Moltmann, in his essay, we won't get into it, we'll talk a little bit about it, but he does talk about that even though it wasn't exactly Christianity, there was the cross of the fatherland that was given to heroes in Germany as well, kind of a different kind of symbol. But other images or things you can think of, yes?
Just the irony of having In God We Trust on our money, that symbolism in terms of commerce and materialism and almost a justification of that.
And we had mentioned, I think it was the first day of this kind of religious, political, the way that ideologies all get, you know, connected and tied together, that our economic system gets tied to our religious system, that it's kind of Christian to be capitalist somehow. And I could bring a number of Time magazines where the covers are, you know, Christian capitalist. And there's the man on the cover with the Bible in his hand, you know, and talking about, and the prosperity gospel and a number of these things. So economics, nationalism, Christianity, and all of this getting kind of woven together so that the symbols even become indistinguishable.
I was surfing on the 4th of July, you know, the usual guy thing, popping from channel, and I hit an evangelical. And I don't try to diss evangelicals, but I was so stunned by what I saw because it was an auditorium filled with maybe 5,000, 6,000 people, all with American flags, but it was a worship service. And in front, over the screens, they were overlaying the flag and the cross, and they were actually, you know, I was so stunned. I mean, I'm patriotic too, but to see that, and it just being so blatantly interwoven, really took my breath away.
And maybe you have, I know I've at least worked at one church where Sunday morning the flag marched in and out of the church. It did about four runs in and out. As the pastor, somebody would go and find it in some closet and put it up front, you know, and then the pastor would see it and go up there and take it out and try to hide it in some closet. Well, it was back up there. It usually made its way back up there wherever it had been. And then there was this constant movement before the service started, and I think the pastor usually won on the symbolic battle in the church, and he wrote a long thing about why the flag, in his mind, didn't belong in front of the church. But some think that it does belong there. You know, you do have, I think, a number of churches still have World War II and on, this kind of battle of symbols. And what we think about those symbols together, do they belong together, don't they belong together, and it raises great passion on all sides on that. So maybe you also have seen these symbolic wars as well as what I was assuming.
The year after 9/11, Sunday was 9/11, and our church did just that. It was a patriotic service, and I'm chairman of the worship and music committee, and nothing I said could help, including the pastor, felt that was what we needed to do. So rather than really, you know, raise a big fuss, my husband and I went and worshiped at a Catholic church in Tacoma, because we knew there would be no flags in the symbol, because if they'd had a program in the afternoon to honor the flag and all of that, it would have been wonderful, but to call it worship, it just didn't fit for me.
I grew up in a Lutheran church that had the Lutheran flag that was the cross over, it just mirrors the American flag on one side and the American flag on the other. I think most people had that image, but it's so, I those ideas of blurring the American flag and the Christian church as one is really, you know, you didn't really realize that was what was going on at that time, but now that this discussion is happening, I realize, boy, we really had a lot of blurring of mixed messages in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. I think every church has.
I might be a bit off topic, but I wonder if anyone, in light of what several people have said about the American flag and the Christian symbols being together, has anyone read Mark Twain's The War Prayer?
Yeah, that's a good
one. I think that was a genius piece of work that kind of describes, peripherally at least, where we're at here. The people from one side, one nation going to war against another, and they're praying to their God to help us to be victorious and destroy the enemy and eradicate their crops and torture their people and cast their children into hunger and starvation so that we may be victorious, please God. And he kind of ends the piece by saying, don't you think the other side wants to do the same thing?
We have lots of, I think we can think of a lot of images here. Let me throw out a couple different then interpretations that some of these theologians, and I think they do work with the topic of the cross and imperialism in different ways. Jürgen Moltmann, we've talked about earlier, his work on the crucified God, that the cross reveals God's love. This is older. This wasn't necessarily, well, let's leave it at that. The cross reveals God's love, the love of a crucified God made vulnerable in love, who opens God's self to the pain of the world. And it's interesting, he said, and this is the meaning of true power, true love, to willingly feel the pain of the beloved. This work was often referenced by Latin American liberation theologians. He does address in a short section in The Crucified God, Then and Now, 20 years later, in looking back at The Crucified God. And he does say, I have been critiqued by Dorothea Zola, another German theologian, and other feminist theologians for having an abusive thing. And his response is, and I do think maybe they just get tired too at some point. It's like, I would never meant that. I would never mean that. I would be horrified it would be used that way. You know, I didn't mean it that way. He doesn't address them specifically, their critiques specifically enough, but it does sound a little tired, like, good grief, why would I say that? He's married to a feminist German theologian. A more detailed response might be helpful as well. So I both understand him being tired. And I think a detailed response would be nice. He does, in the second essay, I told some of you when I asked him to contribute to here and to give some thoughts on the crucified God then and now, he gave me this article to reprint, and he said, but I want to offer a different one too. And the different one was the critique of how the cross is used in imperialism in particular, and how he felt as a young German soldier abused by people wielding the cross, using both asking him to sacrifice and the blood of all these young German men being thrown to the slaughter. Especially, he mentions a couple of the battles, you know, in World War I, where it was a lost cause and they were throwing the young men out there to die. And he said, this is pointless, you know. There's no redemption in that. That's suffering with no redemption. It's just slaughter. And there's nothing good about it. So he's not a wholesale, suffering is not always good for him either. So he offers a critique of the cross as a tool of empire, how it's been used repeatedly as a goad and justification for slaughter and self-sacrifice. And contrary to this, he says he found Christ crucified when he was a POW as both his brother in need and his liberator, he says. And this was very different from the version he was getting from the German military ideology. There's something I wanted to add. He mentions, I'm going to have to step back to actually see this here. Let me read a few lines out from his, okay, there are two. I was mentioning to you on Monday, some of you on Monday, that Constantine has replaced the devil as the biggest bad guy in theology in the last 10 years. And I probably couldn't sit down and systematically prove it to you. But Constantine does come up within the last 10 years as the one who royally wrecked Christianity. And people are so mad at Constantine for wrecking it. Rightly so, right? Probably our concern with nationalism and the cross, nationalism and Christianity, that in a way the devil has dropped out of some of these arguments as Constantine has become the one who warped the cross into this tool of imperialism. Moltmann writes, chapter is called The Cross as Military Symbol for Sacrifice. At the beginning of Christianity, there are two crosses. One is a real cross, the other a symbol. One is a murderous gallows of terror and oppression. The other is a dream cross of an emperor. One is for victims of violence, the other for violent conquerors. The one is full of blood and tears, the other empty. The first stands on Golgotha and Jesus hangs on it. The other is the victorious dream of the Emperor Constantine in the year 312 CE. What has the second to do with the first? How could the memory of a victim of injustice and violence be changed into a symbol of victorious injustice and violence? And then he says, when the Emperor Constantine saw a cross at night and heard the voice, in this sign you shall conquer, he ordered his soldiers to paint the Cairo on their shields, and lo, they fought and won the battle at the Milvian Bridge and conquered Rome for their lord and master. This, and not Golgotha, was the beginning of the Christian Empire, destined to conquer the world for Christ and his anointed Caesar. One can still see the cross associated with military victory depicted on the ceilings of old Byzantine churches. Salvation is inside the Christian Empire, damnation outside. In the Crusades and Holy Wars, non-Christian people were confronted with two alternatives, baptism or death. He mentions on 261, in World War I, Golgotha, in quotes, was repeated in the particularly bloody battles of Verdun and Flanders. Every meaningless death in this war was interpreted as a noble sacrifice. It was as though there were no victims at all, only heroes. The original Christian religion changed quickly into a national war religion. The God of Jesus was replaced by the war God, demanding more and more sacrifices, victimizing millions, and swallowing up the young generations of the nations. Pastoral care in World War II Germany was strangely centered on a military theology of the cross. In 1942, Catholic bishops sent a circular letter to Catholic soldiers on the Russian front saying, quote, when the Lord calls you in this war to a soldier's death, the death of a confessor, give up your life in the cross of the Lord as an expiatory sacrifice for our sins and the redemption of our people. When the Lord calls you in the dark Gethsemane hour, in the suffering of wounds or in the imprisonment, take it upon yourselves as the cross in the passion of the Lord. He mentions again, I think he says it quite nicely. He says, my resolution after this time was never again to become a victim. This is after him being a prisoner of war and also being a young soldier on the German front for just a very short amount of time before he was captured. He says, during my imprisonment, I found Christ the crucified as my brother in need and my liberator. This was a very different image of the cross than the one presented by the sacrifice religion within wartime Germany. The Son of Man came, quote, to seek out and save the lost, unquote, Luke 19:10. And he found me in my God-forsakenness and took me with himself on the way to the, quote, broad place where there is no oppression anymore, unquote, paraphrase from Job 36. Christ crucified, liberated me from affirming the terrors produced by those who utilize the cross as military symbol. Hold on to this. This is one of his ways of talking about how the cross is used as a tool of empire. Douglas John Hall is not a Lutheran theologian, but he likes Luther's theology of the cross, or Luther's epistemology of the cross, if we take Mary Solberg's phrase. Douglas John Hall is a Canadian theologian belonging to the United Church of Canada. He says, he also talks about Christianity holding hands with imperial power, emphasizes a God of power and might. These are triumphalistic theologies of glory. And I think he's using this phrase correctly, that when you talk about when we create theologies about God, where we begin is often in kind of images of power and might and triumphalism. And these kind of glorified images become these kind of lead to self-serving theologies of glory, ways that we can actually use this theology to better our own situation. He says, the cross reveals that God is humble and suffering, not a God of glory and power who conquers in might. He thinks we need the cross. Christianity at this point, and as a Canadian particularly in the United States. The United States cannot lose the weakness of God, because we're already using it in a power, might, conquering way, he thinks, with the kind of crusade. And so the cross is a corrective to say, no, your God is not that kind of God. Your God is loving, vulnerable, shows love through weakness, vulnerability, and dies on a cross. This is not let's go out and get them and use the power of God behind us, because it's the opposite message of the cross. So he says, now more than ever, to combat the powers of imperialism and the temptation to associate Christianity with it, we need the cross. Anna Catherine.
I'm just realizing this week how deeply affected I have been by the Maltese cross, which I am wearing. And it's because I lived in Malta, because I was teaching. I became very intrigued by the Knights of Malta, fought in the Crusades. And when I taught nursing students, it was to emphasize that the Maltese cross to the Knights of Malta, it could have been imperialism. I've never thought of that particularly, except that they said that it was the 8 points of the cross, of the Maltese cross, were the Beatitudes. Blessed are the meek, you know. And when I would read that to my nursing students, they all felt so affected and I think in awe of what that crusade was all about. Now, I'll know there is another side to that, but it's interesting for me to hear how many people have a negative impression of the cross, because I have just the opposite.
Right.
And it was because of my experience. And then when I heard yesterday about the feminists who, you know, see the cross as a sign of suffering and domestic violence and all of the pain that it caused for them, that is just contrary to what I believe. And I don't have to do with it.
Well, I could insist on a different interpretation of the cross, of saying that is the Rebecca Ann Parker or the others when we were talking about them yesterday. And in my pastoral care counseling with women, they said, you know, the most common phrase of domestic violence victims was, this is my cross to bear.
Yeah.
In emergency rooms across the country, that this was the phrase that people reported hearing the most and not knowing, you know, what to do with this, because it is, it's symbolic, it's theological, you're dealing with a lot of profound beliefs in different ways. But I think there's lots of people who are insisting that the cross does mean something else.
Yeah. It seems like though what these people are saying is that this is what their experience has been. And therefore they associate either pain or peace with what the cross has meant to them, and they write about that. But and I think they have a right to write about it. But I can't connect with that.
Yeah. Well, I know even with the Moltmann article, it sent things, my parents, they'll still read things, you know, I sent this off and I had forgotten, I'd left Jürgen Moltmann's name off, so she didn't know it was a German theologian, and she said, we never interpret the deaths at Flanders and these battles to be meaningless. What does he mean? I mean, we interpreted these as, these are noble deaths, like he's saying, but you know, he does talk about this hero, and she also, I mean, it's, there's so many interpretations. I understand, Catherine. I think it's such a, I mean, I understand exactly where you're coming from. For me, it is one of those things where Parker and Brock and Brown, those critiques, I don't want to dismiss them or put them away. I kind of want them to live with me. It's almost, and I was thinking today when we were hiking, I had put it in the words of like Elie Wiesel's question, Questions in Night. You know, the book ends fairly, well, hopeless, and you know, where is God in suffering? And I will not accept your explanations, your easy explanations of where God is. It's too awful. And that question, just having that question hang and not answering it, in some ways for me is a way of honoring that. I want to let their critique of the cross just sit, as much as I don't want to try to answer Elie Wiesel and speak like Job's friends, Proverbs of Ashes, or like what Parker and Brock are saying, you know, your words are prop. When you try to explain it to me, it's just Proverbs of Ashes, you know.
There's one thing I didn't say, which I should say for the rest of the people, is that the reason I was teaching about the Knights of Malta wasn't because of their war effort, but they were the first nurses of the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And they had an order that was caring for people, too. So you can't just box it in and say they were warriors.
Yes.
They were also gentle people.
Yeah.
So that is the conflict, is to try to say, well, the cross means this. Yeah. At different times and to different people, it means different things.
Yeah.
So should we reject what it has meant to us because of all of this writing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, like you're saying, is there something to even following, and I'm just ad-libbing here, so I mean, in the sense of responding to what you're saying, is there something to saying it's okay to even allow my own interpretations to move with different contexts I encounter? In this context, well, and I mentioned Douglas John Hall and I actually, he said this is a great anti-imperialistic message. And our conversation that brought about actually the book cross-examinations was, I said, it doesn't work in the emergency room. And he said, but it's necessary in this world. I said, I agree, it doesn't work in the emergency room. Your image doesn't work. It's damaging in this context. What do we do? Do we want to settle on something? And maybe you can come up with one answer that will appease all, or maybe not. I'm not sure. Or whether things move and grow. He has, I'll throw these out and then just open it up. If people can remember, this is more interesting. He does talk about the cross in our context. The word of the cross reveals the darkness of the world, looking at some of the Luther's epistemology of the cross, of being able to see pain, and gives light so we can find our way somehow in the cross. He uses the phrase, the theology of the cross is not able to shut its eyes to all the things that are wrong with the world and with ourselves, our human selves, our Christian selves. It doesn't accentuate the negative, as its critics sometimes claim, but it does want to acknowledge the presence and reality of that which negates and threatens life. Death and doubt and the demonic are still with us, and Luther never tired of talking about them or struggling with them. Any faith that depends on denying all that darkness isn't faith at all, in the biblical sense of the term. It's credulity, repression, and self-deception. The word of the cross doesn't banish darkness, it lightens it, which means that the gospel both reveals the darkness for what it truly is and provides enough light for us to make our way within it one step at a time. It's kind of a beautiful phrase. I can throw out Mark Lewis Taylor as somebody who, he hasn't developed it quite as much as Moltmann and Hall, but he talks, his chapter is called American Torture in the Body of Christ, and he contrasts American, he is a United States citizen, and I mention that just because Douglas John Hall is Canadian, and he came to PLU to talk, and he just railed against the United States and our use of the cross. And I have students who hear that, I mean, people who were there were a little bit stunned, but our students in class were just like, oh, you know, we have a strong military population at BLU, too. We have we're ROTC, we're a ROTC school. So you have kids in uniform listening to Douglas John Hall, just like, what is he talking about? You know, how can he say those things? But Mark Lewis Taylor is someone internal to the United States, and he talks about American torture and our practices of torture, our practices of dismembering and violence. Where he says the body of Christ, and particularly the Eucharist, is a way that Christians remember the body of Christ. And it's a creative performance that's done in the Eucharist of joining the body of Christ and remembering it. And he thinks that it actually is a life-giving, constructive opposition to practices of torture. So not necessarily, he's not concentrating on Jesus' death as much as he is at our practice of the Eucharist as a way of countering practices of torture, and that Eucharist could actually be seen as political resistance. it's a bit of a complicated argument, and I'm not exactly sure it's all solid yet. It's very interesting, and there's lots of imagery and stories that are going on in it, but it's, and he does have a book on the topic of torture and brings up the Eucharist in there. But now let's go back to, so those are some of the perspectives that we've been dealing with. Go back even to Catherine's question, there were a few hands up of other things of looking at all these interpretations of the cross and what are we to do with this room full of people, us and these people on the walls. Here. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Ron.
In all of this, I'm beholden to the testimony of witnesses of the followers of Jesus in those first 300 years. Mm. And one of their main tenets was a commitment not to shed blood of any other human being. And I take that as their witness to their understanding of the cross. Today we label that pacifism in some regards. Not passivism, but pacifism. And just looking at the testimony and witness of Jesus leading up to that cross, and the clearing out of the temple, the woes to the religious leaders of the day, I mean, it was political resistance par excellence.
So Ron, when you look at the, let me just ask then, when you look at the cross today then,
yes.
Is that the primary meaning? One of the primary meanings that you carry to it is a symbol of nonviolent
resistance. It is.
Mm-hmm. You've brought up things around that a couple times, and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry. So we'll go back here.
It just occurred to me, in this whole discussion that, like in Arlington, and to see, the cemetery, and what do they mark all the graves with? And it never occurred to me before today how that connects the cross with war. Does anybody know when we started marking graves and military cemeteries with crosses?
The Civil War.
When?
The Civil War. Yeah, that's what they said when I went to
crosses we see.
Yeah.
But they offer the alternative of the Star of David.
Yeah.
Or no cross at all.
So what?
Just wondering how they think. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad. But
right.
But it's powerful to see that.
It's very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say a word on behalf of Constantine. without denying his obvious political use and abuse of Christianity, or the horrible crimes that followed in the wake of, of him, whether, through the Crusades and onward, that Christianity became a world religion because it got into bed with the Roman Empire. And that we are all probably Christians today because of Constantine. And furthermore, that what we call our Western tradition, culturally speaking, is a direct result of that, of the power of the state behind the dissemination and the glorification of Christian images. If you ever walked into an ancient church and enjoyed it, that's, you're benefiting from that. That's not to mention the Renaissance or any of that wonderful art.
Mm-hmm.
So, which isn't to say that we should critique it, or that, we shouldn't be very, very aware of imperialism's use of Christianity in our own day. But it does definitely accrue certain benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it clearly has been successful. It's been a mode of success.
Well, I was just thinking, at one of the talks I made this morning, and we were talking about the opposition of both and. Mm-hmm. And being able to put that together and move away from the either or. The cross has to mean this, or it has to mean this. But can we look at it as the cross means both this and this, and live with that paradox, and to be aware that someone's wearing of the cross somebody else's interpretation or their experience with that might be very different than your own. And just to be sensitive and aware that because of someone's position in life or where they were born or what they have experienced, that symbol might be very different for them.
I can't come up with the professor at LSTC that's done a lot of work on Revelation and with them. Help me out. Well, I was just thinking about how this might fit in with that. The Left Behind series, you know, talking about the end of the world is Empire. So, never mind if you don't know who it is. But that whole idea of, you know, Jesus coming back and plucking out some and leaving the rest behind.
Mm-hmm. And the United Nations is the seat of the Antichrist. So, what is not nationalistic, so ideally, or represents multiple, I don't know how to talk about that, but I mean, it is kind of, it could be interesting to think about further there.
Well, the thing that's really struck me the first day I sat in this class and throughout the week has been, I mean, we're talking about a symbol. We're talking about, I mean, we all know the historical fact of Jesus was crucified on this cross-shaped thing, but it was turned into a symbol, and it seems to me it's entirely pliable. You know, you could make that symbol anything you want, and the appropriation of symbols is sort of the intellectual history of the human race. And the value of this class for me has been, and I think the value of looking at this diversity of interpretations, is that it helps clarify for me where, in my experience, where the truth lies. Not necessarily, you know, what's wrong with the world necessarily, but where I'm trying to find meaning and how I'm trying to understand my own experience in the world. That it's not that there's a rightness or wrongness in an objective sense to any of these. Because, I mean, what is it? I mean, it's you can't even touch it. It's not concrete in any, it's not really concrete. But how does that reflect on our life and how we pursue a meaningful life? Seems to be the only point of talking about symbols in this life.
And someone did say, you know, if we never move to, it's a great, interesting conversation, but then what will, without ignore, I mean, the one of those things without withholding the chorus of voices somehow in your mind, is it possible to still act in some way in the world? And it does seem, I'd have to say, they all are on the side of courageous living and not meaningless suffering. I think they agree on the route to get there, and the symbols we choose to get there are what we're going to argue about, and whether they should be there or shouldn't be there. But it seems to be that they're committed to a certain path of ethics, a way of following Christ, but not necessarily.
And it's as much about the use as the abuse of the symbol. So what can be an important symbol to you in finding your personal truth, and how that encourages you in your life. It's that whole piece of how that's abused and turned against people.
Yeah. It's kind of, oh, please.
I want to ask you, your impression of the use of the cross by Christian athletes and use of prayer for victory.
Well, you know, I'm not much of a sports person, so I should be, but I could connect to ideologies of imperialism. Might not be that extreme, you know, whether the Vikings or the, give me another team, win, you know, I mean, it's like, but, you know, I think there is something to that of the claiming it of making the cross, you know, but it can mean so many things. That's the thing. It could mean protection. It could mean, I hope I win. It can mean God's with us. PLU won football games for 362 games in a row or something crazy like that, you know, and they started every time prayer. And You know, this would be, I think this conversation would be a little shocking to a number of my football players and Frosty, our football coaches, you know, interpretation of, you know, Christianity. And but I think it, you know, some of these, it can mean so many things. Yeah, but it is, it's out there. There were another, where were these other hands? Other thoughts or comments people want to offer? We are out of time, actually. But I want to thank you for all of your thoughts and your comments this week. So.